Well, it's September 27th, 2007. We're in Campbell Hall in Urbana. I'm Jim Meadows, and I'm talking to Merlin Tabor, who lives here in Champaign. But when you were growing up, where did you grow up, Merlin?
I grew up in on a farm in Iowa, and near Cedar Rapids.
Okay.
A dirt farm.
What does dirt farm mean? I've always wondered.
Horses.
Horses.
I guess meaning you get your hands dirty.
Okay. Now, when the war began, say 1949, when the U.S. really got into the war, how old were you?
In 39, I was 13 years old.
Okay.
I had moved ahead in school, so I graduated from high school that year.
Graduated from high school at age 13?
Is that right? No, that can't be right. Of course not. I graduated from high school at age 17, I'm sorry. I went to high school at age 13.
Okay, so were you just entering high school in 1939?
In 1939, I was going to high school. It was a friend's Quaker boarding school. We had excellent teachers. And so they informed us about world events.
Now, where was the boarding school?
Ohio. Ohio, southeastern Ohio hills is a hotbed of Quakerism, if I can put it that way. There aren't too many Quakers, but Ohio is one center, and there's a boarding school there.
So you might have a situation where you would hear one view of the war and the current events, say, back home in Iowa, and then go out to the boarding school in Ohio and hear a different view of the war.
Well, I had that situation in my family because my father's side of the family were Quaker, and he's the one who arranged for me to go to boarding school. I came from a broken home, but I was closely in touch with both sides of the family. My mother's family were true blue patriot Midwestern Methodists, and there was a large family, and they were very much in favor of the war. Well, not in favor of the war, but they assumed that everyone did military service and did whatever they could.
What was the argument then from the Quaker point of view as to how to regard this war and what people's responsibility was?
It wasn't so much this war as war in general. Going back to, for most Quakers, it goes back to the teachings of Christ, thou shalt not kill. And I think that as Quakers have become more sophisticated, It has also based on the futility of violence, that violence leads to more violence, and has side effects that nobody understands. And most of my friends, however, when I talk this way, some of my friends get upset with me because they believe that it should be a personal conviction that you couldn't use violence against another human being. A centerpiece of Quaker belief says every human being is divine. All humans have something of the divine in them. And so you don't kill other people for any reason.
Well, as a teenager at that time, how were you taking this all in? What were you thinking at the time?
I think that I'm like most teenagers. I wasn't sure what I thought. And at the age of 18, when I registered, I did ask for conscience objector status on religious grounds. But I was not at all firmly convinced that I personally, and I still am not, that I personally am a nonviolent person.
Were you thinking at the time, were you torn at the time between seeking a CO status and maybe deciding, well, maybe it's right to fight in this war?
Yes, I was. And, of course, a number of people like me, there's a third alternative, which is to volunteer for medic service in the Army. At that time, at least, you could do that. And they promised you wouldn't carry a gun, although some medics did. But quite a few religious semi-objectors did that.
Well, how did you finally come to make up your mind?
I decided that the argument against killing other human beings, the proscription against killing other human beings, was a very sound argument logically, and that I was a Quaker in sympathy and at least intellectually, and while I was not sure that I could be nonviolent in every situation, I thought, I'm opposed to taking up arms, so I ask for CO status.
And they must, in some way, at least, you know, the general public memory of the war today is that it was a popular war, and you certainly don't see any Hollywood movies about conscientious objectors.
No.
So how did it feel? Did you feel you were really going against the tide?
Yes, I believe most COs felt like an embattled minority, but of course we all had support systems in our friends, family, and church pretty much. In my home county, which is Linn County, Cedar Rapids, Iowa, the draft board knew about COs. In many counties, other people had the experience of asking for CO status and being refused because the draft board really just simply didn't understand what they were talking about. Mm-hmm. In my case, they had this request before, and they probably personally knew something about Quakers from personal from living in that county. And so after they satisfied themselves that this was not a last-minute conversion, that I had a history of several years of participation in peace movements and in religious services and experiences, and was recognized in those circles. When they satisfied themselves of that, then they gave me 4E, conscientious objector, status. When I visited with the family on my mother's side, many of my cousins, probably a half dozen by that time, were already in uniform. And they really had not the foggiest idea what I was talking about. Basically, they tried to be polite. They were noncommittal. They tried to respect what I was doing as far as they could.
Did you ever have any involved conversations with them about it, or did it just stay on the polite side?
It stayed on the polite side. One of my cousins was in the Navy, and I was closer to him. He said, by that time he was committed to a medical education, and so he said he knew guys in the Navy who were in the medical corps who were religious, who were COs like I was, so he understood that.
So what happened next? You had the status.
I had the classification, and my birthday, this all happened rapidly in the winter of, let's see, I became 18 in 1944, late in 1944, and they sent me to Fort Leonard Wood to have a physical exam. I also had a mental exam. The psychiatrist asked me if I was close to my mother. I think he was working on a personal theory that COs probably had mother fixations, and so he quizzed me about this. And other than that was non-eventful. I passed the physical. Soon after that, I was called up. And at the time I was called up, I became subject to the authority of the government, but in effect, they farmed out administration of the CO camps to the peace churches, the three peace churches, Quakers, Mennonites, and Brethren. So those administrators sent me to a camp, decided where I would go.
So instead of reporting to a branch of military service like the Army or the Navy, you reported to, it was civilian public service?
A civilian public service camp. And many of them were, well, these were supposed to be work of national importance, which took different meanings. There was some argument that these camps should be in remote places because they didn't want these COs propagandizing other people. Many of the camps had to do with development of infrastructure, roads and dams out west, dirt dams. Later in the war, there were a number of many CO camps or units in mental hospitals, because during the war, even the unemployables that state mental hospitals would find for attendance, even they were becoming unavailable because there was such high employment rates. They could get a better job in a factory. So it was mental hospitals, in some cases general hospitals, even some cases children's homes, but many of them were work in the forest. My location was a project to develop irrigation facilities along the Columbia River in North Dakota. And so in early 1945, I was sent to this camp near Trenton, North Dakota, along the river, Missouri River. And we mixed concrete, shoveled sand and gravel to mix concrete. We made huge pipes, 2, 3, 4 feet in diameter, for irrigation water. We built roads, irrigation ditches, partly with machinery, partly by hand. This was a good-sized camp. Like a lot of the CPS camps, it was in an old CCC, Civilian
Conservation Corps?
Thank you, Civilian Conservation Corps. Yeah. A New Deal program of the 1930s, and the camps were still around, and some of the men who were employed to run the CPS camps were also honchos or directors from CCC days.
Mm-hmm. How was the work? I mean, you grew up on a... Mm-hmm. Now, you grew up on a farm, so yes. I imagine you already knew what hard work was like.
Yeah.
How did this work compare? What was it like?
This was hard work. We got up early, had some breakfast, worked long hours. In the evening, there was whatever amusement we could create, which wasn't much. There were political discussions. There must have been, we were occupying 10 or 12, I don't remember, old CCC barracks, and each of the barracks took on a distinctive flavor. There was the New York barrack, there were the Dukhobors from the northern part of the country, there was us.
Dukhobors.
Well, these are a semi-communist religious group that, in general, they don't believe in cooperating with the government at all. Mm-hmm. They don't. In fact, they try to live without paying taxes, which is actually impossible, but they do their best not to pay even property taxes on their farms if they can avoid it. They lead a simple life like the Amish, and they try to avoid society. They were like us Midwest farm boys. They worked hard. The camp managers liked them. The New York fellows, they would rather argue than work. And who else? What else was there? I encountered a mixture of people, some Catholics and other churches. There were even a sprinkling of men who weren't quite sure how they ended up in CPS. One fellow, Good Food Gus, who was a very good cook and worked in the kitchen, claimed that he was trying to get into the Merchant Marine, and he claimed he didn't understand how he ended up here in North Dakota, but I don't know.
What was the flavor of the barrack that you were in?
Midwest farm boys.
And were they people like you, people from Peace Church background?
That's correct. Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, you know, living in a camp with that range of people who were all drawn together by their opposition to the war in some way, was that new to you at the time?
Oh, yes. This was, I suppose, in a bully adventure for me. My background was very limited of travel. I don't think I met any Jewish people, black people, until I got to college or later. That's why I was emphasizing being a dirt farm kid. In those days, you didn't travel either. So the state fair was about the farthest away we farm kids were apt to get.
Now, had you had some college at the time you went into this?
Yes, I had a year and a half.
Where'd you go to college?
I went to a tiny Quaker college where I could work my way through in southern Iowa.
And what's the name?
William Penn College.
William Penn College.
As the name indicates, it had a Quaker background. Mm-hmm. And at that time, like my boarding school, there were a number of active Quaker professors. So, again, I was exposed to anti-war thinking and pacifist philosophy in college.
So you're at this camp. What was the discipline? Was it military-style discipline, or what was it?
Well, it was, let's see. I'm hesitating because I don't know of any disciplinary problems.
Well, I mean, just was it very regimented? Did you have to fall in?
I'm sorry. The daily routine was much more like a CCC camp, I suppose. You get up and people yell at each other. You find something to eat, and then you go to work. as far as the spit and polish, standing at attention, all of those things, no, there was none of that whatsoever.
No uniforms.
Of course, the Army wanted nothing to do with these camps. They had enough, more than enough headaches without that. And the men in CPS and the peace churches who were sponsoring them and, in fact, paying for them, it was a good deal for the government. They got some kind of useful work out of us, and they didn't pay us anything. The peace churches paid the costs. We had an allowance which could be something, I forget what it was, a few dollars, maybe $5 a month for spending money.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, like you talked about occupying yourself in the evenings, was there a weekend, and did you, was there any place to go? Or did
well,
you...
the town of Trenton, I think in several months that I was there, I only got to Trenton once or twice because we didn't have much transportation. And of course, during the war, nobody had gas, and we could get gas for the machines, the road machines and so forth. But as far as private cars, there weren't any. And so you had to arrange for a ride on a truck to go to town, and it was, as I recall, at least an hour away, the nearest town. And I suppose it was 3,000 or 4,000 people.
And what sort of reception did people from the CPS camp get in town?
Oh, very cold. So yeah, we didn't try to go there too often. I was given a very strange haircut once because the barber found out I was at the CPS camp, so he butchered up my haircut as a means of supporting the war.
Mm-hmm. You were at that particular camp for how long?
I think I was trying to recall. I think it was March through May or June. Mm-hmm. It was 3 or 4 months.
Okay. It's about the time the war in Europe.
This is true. Ending. The war was already winding down. The Germans had, by that time, I didn't learn this until my reading in subsequent years, but the Germans had basically lost the war by that time in the East. They had lost their best troops and best machinery on the three eastern fronts. And it was winding down.
But about that time, were you simply reassigned at one point?
I volunteered. They put out a call for volunteers to fight fires in Southern California because they were also undermanned. The Forest Service couldn't find anybody for summer service, and they were worried about the fire season. So they recruited volunteer COs around the country and shipped us to Southern California.
What made you decide to volunteer? You could have stayed.
I think, well, of course, it was boring there, but I think it was my farm boy. That's why I always tell people I'm a farm boy. I suppose I wanted to see the world, and I had never been in California. As far as I can remember, I'd never been. Maybe I'd been to Oklahoma. That was the farthest west I'd been.
So what was the work in California like?
Well, there were smoke jumpers, there were different kinds of rangers and firefighters, but my particular assignment was to a ranger base in the valley below San Bernardino National Forest near the city of San Bernardino. And we had an ancient truck with a 500-gallon drum of water on the back and pumps and hoses and a big bench where we sat. A crew of five of us and the driver would speed as far as we could speed in this old truck, which was it was difficult to get it above 40 miles an hour. We would make haste to the fire and try to put it out. As you can imagine, those fires in that country, if they get away, you have big problems. But if you can get there in the first half hour or so, with a little water, you can put them out. That was our job.
Were you successful generally?
We were successful in the sense that we put out a lot of fires. Also, sometimes we were trucked up into the forest on a bigger fire. Sometimes there were lightning fires in trees up in the forest. So when they were spotted, they'd call for us, to three or four of us, to go up in a pickup and figure out how to put out this lightning fire, which would be a fire burning in one tree. It might take it a couple of days, but if you left it, it would start a major forest fire.
Now, were you staying in barracks the same way that you were?
Exactly. Well, these were Forest Service barracks, but they were very similar. And the forest ranger was an old cuss who was very tough, but also very fair. He was basically our boss. He gave us our assignments, and sometimes he went to the fire with us, sometimes he didn't. Mm-hmm.
So the people you would see at the work would be other CPS people? And that
there were six of us living together in a shack, or I shouldn't say a shack, a barracks, which it was very much like the CPS barracks. One of us turned out he knew how to cook. He was a married man who had experience cooking. So he was elected cook against his will, and he tried to rotate the job when he could. But he cooked. We ate very well because we had an allowance of, I don't know, a few dollars a week, which in those days actually permitted a good diet.
The forest ranger, I mean, did he treat you a certain way because you were CPS?
No, I think he was like the managers that I met in the Bostas in North Dakota. He wasn't sympathetic. He, as far as he was concerned, he had the forest to work about, to worry about, and if we did a job, good. Mm-hmm. He wasn't friendly. He wasn't hostile. He pushed us very hard, and he worked very hard himself.
Now in that situation where you were again too far from town to get in any place anywhere much. Did you get to town in that case?
Yeah, I got to L.A. a few times. I'm laughing because you can imagine as a naive farm kid floating around L.A. and San Diego. I had some interesting adventures, but I went when they gave us a little time off. I would go and try to get a job to make a few dollars, then spend it traveling. Perhaps I can tell one story. I ran into a friend in L.A. I ran into a man who became a friend. He was a black fellow. Very good looking, very sharp, very intelligent. He had a master's degree in Spanish from Harvard University. And as I say, he was very attractive. And he and I cooked up a plan. We had about $15 or $20 between us to go down in the Baja Peninsula and spend a couple days in Mexico. On the way, we hitchhiked to San Diego. We went into a near the waterfront, we went into a Greasy Spoon near the waterfront, sat down at the counter, and ordered coffee and a hamburger. I noticed that other people were being waited on who came in after we did. I began to look around. It gradually sunk into my head that we were basically in the South, and he was black and I was white, and they weren't going to serve us. And when I looked at him, I realized he had seen, naturally, he'd seen this a long time before I had. And first I called the waitress over and said, "What's the matter?" She said, she was very embarrassed, "I'm sorry, we can't serve you." I looked at my friend, his name was Sydney, as I recalled. I said, "Sydney, should we make a fuss about this?" He didn't want to, understandably. He wanted to get out. So we found a Greasy Spoon in a worse neighborhood. That was San Diego. This was my first personal introduction. As I say, I was a naive farm kid. This is my first personal introduction to
And that was San Diego. That was not the Jim Crow South, but that was the way
it was. This was San Diego. Well,
but that was the way things were.
This is wartime. There were sailors everywhere. A lot of the sailors were from the South. And anyway, we crossed the border and took a broken down bus south into Mexico. We happened to hit this town, found a hotel for $3 a night we could afford. It turned out that they were having the high school prom dance the very night that we arrived. So we looked at each other and decided to go. My friend, to make a long story short, the lady, the lovely girls were sitting around the edge. Everyone had one or two chaperones sitting up behind them and watching like a hawk. The men, the boys, were on in one corner, and they would scatter out and try to get somebody to dance with them. My friend was the hit of the ball. He was the belle of the ball.
Now, this was in Mexico.
With his looks, his ability to speak Spanish, and being a stranger, and a very good dancer, he was the center of envious attention. I was the only white person in the, well, not white, the only North American pasty-faced person. And I tried, he taught me what to say to ask someone to dance. I tried three or four, and gradually it sunk through my thick head that I was poison from the looks I was getting. So I became more and more uncomfortable, and then I told my friend, Sydney, I'm going back to the hotel, I'll see you later. So this was sorry to take so long, but it was my farm boy introduction to race relations.
Mm-hmm. Now, was Sydney from the CPS camp?
Not Sydney? From a different one. I don't even remember where he was, but okay. We just bumped into each other, I think, at some kind of Quaker center, where we could get a bed for $2 a night, mm-hmm. in Los Angeles. We teamed up for this trip.
Did you ever see him again after that?
Yes, I saw him. We kept in touch for two or three years. Then we both started families, and we lost touch.
Mm-hmm. You were so you spent a certain amount of time in California on the brush fire detail.
We spent the fire season, and at the end of the fire season, they wanted to get rid of us. Uh-huh. They didn't. The Forest Service didn't really want us around, or they didn't want extra men around in the winter. And so I volunteered again. A call came for volunteers for medical experiments, and this was a medical experiment in Philadelphia. I volunteered to be a guinea pig in a yellow jaundice hepatitis A experiment.
Now, that's a lot different from just doing work.
Yes, it's very different.
Why did you volunteer for that?
Well, I'm sorry to sound so naive, but I was naive. I volunteered as much as anything else to see the East Coast. And I suppose, like every young man in high school age and after, for at least a year or two, most young men, they feel a need to prove themselves. And I think I wanted to prove that I wasn't afraid of anything and was willing to do anything. And
so you went out, this took you out to where now?
Philadelphia.
Okay, and where did they set you up?
Specifically, in this case, our unit was in an old deke. The deke was a drinking fraternity on the Penn campus. And so it was a very beat up old fraternity house, and they had set up this unit, which was supervised by a research doctor from the University of Pennsylvania Medical School. And this experiment I took part in, I only found out later, there was a total of somewhere 40, 50 or more men who were in various units of this experiment at Yale and also at Pennsylvania. My particular unit was only about a dozen men in this fraternity house. We had a nurse who took blood and kept track of our general condition. We were closely supervised because they didn't want us wandering around catching other diseases. So we spent a lot of time sitting in this building, this old decrepit building, and reading.
They didn't want you wandering around. They only wanted you to catch one disease.
They wanted us to catch hepatitis. I was in the experimental group, the X group, which caught hepatitis. And incidentally, only recently I found out that Everett Koop, who was later our national doctor, was connected. He worked as a young man. He worked on that experiment. He said he was very shocked to learn that these CO guinea pigs didn't have any idea about the dangers that they were undergoing. And in fact, several young men died from having hepatitis because they, especially early, they didn't know how to treat it. And so he took part in postmortems on some, looking at the livers of some men who died from yellow jaundice. And this affected his later thinking about human subject policy.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So you were actually putting yourself at some risk.
I didn't have a clear picture of that, how much at the time, mm-hmm. but yes, I was.
Now, this was, you said, the Penn, was it about the University of Pennsylvania?
Yes, it was, basically it was supervised by a doctor, and I'm sorry to say, I've looked up his publications announcing his findings. He, as it happens, he's a Quaker himself. That's how he hit on the idea of recruiting some COs to be subjects, but he developed his own theory about what spread hepatitis, which proved to be correct, namely that human waste, it spread through human waste. So those of us in the experimental group had to ingest, that is, drink some human urine or mixture of feces from people who had yellow jaundice.
Diluted, I would assume.
Diluted. We didn't, again, we didn't know that at the time, but I knew it, we knew it didn't taste good.
Okay.
It was diluted and flavored.
So, you know, you came out there to see Philadelphia, but
yes.
You couldn't have seen too much if you were
well,
sick.
Well, I saw a little bit. And contracted the experimental group, every one of us, I think in that case it was probably five or six people, and every one developed a beautiful yellow case of yellow jaundice, which they now call hepatitis A. And they told us, they warned us, after a week or two, you're going to feel like you've recovered, but you haven't recovered. Your liver is very sensitive. Don't do anything. Don't even do anything as strenuous as dancing, because this is why the Army had losses from jaundice. They put the men back in the line after a week or two because they seemed to be okay. But then they had a relapse and died. And so they warned us that we needed a long period of recovery for our livers to recover. But being, again, a farm boy, I wanted some money to do things around Philadelphia. We had more liberty at that time. So I took a job which involved carrying boxes, which were fairly heavy. I suppose that's the reason, probably, that I did pass out and fell and fractured my skull. So then I had another learning experience, which was to be on the public charity ward of the Philadelphia City Hospital. There was no money, of course, to send me someplace else. So I joined the drunks and the poor people. in the public ward, and this was very educational.
Did you still have the jaundice? Well, you still had the weak liver.
Well, I guess so. But by that time, I realized I had to take care of myself. Mm-hmm. So at least I was more careful.
Being in a public charity hospital, you said, what did you learn?
Well, it was a room about the size of this space, which had something like 40 beds, and they were side by side. So you had somebody in the next bed that could be a victim of a knifing or terminally ill or anything. And the doctors from the medical school brought around bunches of students to look at us periodically. And I suppose we probably received good medical care and supervision. There was one nurse who was a large, loud-spoken woman, and she tried to run the ward like a top sergeant. I think that she herself was mainly responsible to look to be sure everybody was behaving themselves, and taking their medication. And aside from that, we were dressed in hospital gowns, so we couldn't go anywhere, but we generally sat in our bed and talked to each other or whatever. Mm-hmm. Anyway, I made friends there with a couple of guys, including a black guy. I went, my girlfriend and I went to visit him, and I kept in touch with him for a while. After that, they wanted to get rid of us. I volunteered, or they sent me. By that time, it was... I tried to recapitulate this. I suppose by that time it was late summer, maybe 1946.
So the war was over.
The war was over. Some people were being discharged, but there was still no. It wasn't 46. This time, it was 19. Late summer of 1945.
So the war was just ending. The war.
The war was ending, okay. And but nobody had been discharged yet by that time. Although it began to happen soon after, for discharges from CPS, that is, for guys who had been in quite a while. Mm-hmm. They sent me to Byberry Mental Hospital.
Where's that?
That was a very large state mental hospital in northeast Philadelphia. It became famous actually as a snake pit. Films from Byberry were used to good effect in the mental hygiene movement, trying to reform mental health care after World War II. And
the place was used as a bad example, I take it.
Yes, it was. There were 6,000 patients. There were two or three physicians to provide whatever medical care there was. There were, 20, 30 nurses, registered nurses, and then lots of attendants. But during the war, they couldn't find attendants. Normally, they didn't find good people to work there. I mean, they had always put up signs out in the highway nearby Barry trying to hire people. They would hire people off the street. So as a result, they got many drunks and others who were unemployable. Anyway, the buildings were very run down. The buildings were huge, but they were very run down. Something like 20 to 30% were elderly people, burned out, cases of schizophrenia or syphilis, which was still widespread at that time. I was assigned There was one building which was called the Incontinent Building. As you can imagine, this was because 250 people or so there could not control their bowels or their urine. And I was glad not to be assigned to that building. I was assigned to the Violent Building. This had 150 or 200 men, each of whom had either usually had attacked attendants or other patients repeatedly, or who had escaped repeatedly. So they were put in this building. And my most memorable experience from that is the long days that I spent, probably 12-hour days, in the what was called the day room, euphemistically called the day room. This was a large thing about the size of a basketball court where 125 or more men who were all had a history of violence were milling around, and there were two of us young, naive CO people at one end of the room, and we put a row of benches across the room and told the men they couldn't come across the benches. And we stood there and watched what was happening. And then we would go, one of us would go, or two if needed, to break up fights, which broke out all day long. Mm-hmm. That was the way you spent time, except for the times when they went, you had to help herd them to the dining room. And during the daylight hours, since we didn't have enough people to manage to take these patients outside, and they couldn't be trusted not to run away, during the daylight hours, they were in this large room, day room, all day long. And we had something like 12-hour shifts watching them. And as you can imagine, I began smoking. That's where I contracted a smoking habit that lasted 20 or 30 years.
Was that one of the more difficult jobs in terms of, I mean, nothing you did was easy, but that sounded like it was filled with a lot more tension for you.
Well, it was a very unpleasant job. I don't know whether to call it difficult or not. Yeah, it was difficult to manage these guys. They were very unpredictable, and some of them managed to hang on. If they could, they'd hang on to a piece of metal or a utensil from the dining room and sharpen it on concrete and then attack us or attack somebody else. Mm-hmm. So yeah, this was difficult. I think that being a humane, do-good type, well-intentioned person, and being naive, as I keep saying, I mainly felt sorry for these patients, and I thought it was a shame the way they were being treated. And this did carry over. I decided I would try to have a career in developing mental health, better mental health services, and I did.
So that particular duty really shaped your professional life.
It really affected the rest of my life up till today. The kind of work I did and where I went to graduate school and so on and so forth.
Were you able to play a role professionally, or did you at least see changes so that people with those particular conditions are treated differently or better now?
Well, here in Illinois, I got grants to try to help the state or nonprofit organizations develop home care programs and community care programs. I studied the attempts to develop community care here in Illinois in 1970s, I guess it was, 30 or 40 years ago. Actually, Illinois was one of the leaders, one of the most visible leaders in the nation in attempting to develop strong regional and local services. And there was a development. And in fact, most of the old state mental hospitals in Illinois have been closed and put to other uses. Mm-hmm. And I was somebody who was around, not a foremost player, because that had to be the policymakers in Springfield and the people that controlled the state money. But certainly I knew all of these people, and I made reports, I wrote reports, I testified, et cetera, et cetera. I had a series of grants and employed graduate students from sociology, social work, and psychology. And many of them went on to work in this area too.
All this time you were in the CPS, were you writing home, or were you, you know, writing to anybody in the family and letting?
Oh yes, I kept in touch with letters.
What did you tell them?
Pardon me?
What did you tell them in the letters?
Well, I tried to tell them what I thought they would like to hear of my experiences. Yes.
Some things you deliberately kept out?
Oh yes, like the servicemen from that time, I'm sure, there was a lot of self-censorship in writing. Mm-hmm. But also, and when I was in California, for example, one of my mother's sisters was nearby, because she taught an Indian school in Riverside, which was right near. I went and visited her a couple of times, and I told her she had that family's attitude toward the importance of doing your military service. I told her what I was doing, and she looked out the window and said, "Well, that's better than nothing, I guess." But
you must have been reminded a lot then that you weren't getting the same sort of respect that you would have gotten if you had been wearing a uniform.
Well, I think those of us in CPS didn't expect it from the beginning. Mm-hmm. We didn't expect to get the respect, and let's face it, we didn't appreciate it. I would say after the war, let me add that another impact that this experience had on me was, aside from my career, in my heart and mind, to spend, I suppose, the next 60 years examining, was I a pacifist? What did I believe? Everyone has this problem of self-examination. But it was, I think, that the fact that I didn't join in defeating Germany when that was the thing to do, this question was sharpened for me when I was a graduate student. I had a buddy who was a photographer for the Milwaukee newspaper and had served several years with the Army and went and traveled with the Army across Germany, traveled with Eisenhower's Army. And one evening, he opened a trunk and took out literally dozens of pictures, enlargements, of a death camp. He was a member of the forward troops that liberated this death camp, and he documented it. He took pictures. He was shocked, of course, shocked half to death, but he took pictures by the hour. He had dozens, and he and I looked at those. That was my first exposure to what the death camps were. I think now that everybody knows, or everybody who's educated or who reads newspapers knows about the Holocaust. But in fact, in this country, somehow we were very slow to come to terms with what had happened, even at the time. And even though I was a graduate student, I didn't have at all a clear idea. And of course, when I looked at these pictures, I thought, shouldn't I have helped to fight the Nazis who did this? And I would say that this kind of thinking in general led me to many years, which continues to the present, of trying to read world history and a variety of histories of World War II, and the wars, our other oil wars since then, to read these histories. And
you consider World War II to some extent an oil war?
Well, Hitler lost the war in the East. Why did he go east for oil? Mm-hmm. He probably, why was England able to withstand the Blitz? Actually, I think most historians would agree that probably it was because Hitler ran out of oil for his planes and other machines. And if he had had all the oil he wanted, probably England couldn't have survived as it did, as well as it did, which was by the skin of its teeth. Mm-hmm. Why did Japan attack the U.S.? Oil. They saw us as cutting off their access to oil in the south. Well, the Philippines and Indonesia. That's where their oil came.
So they wanted to protect it.
Our navy.
Okay.
I think. Excuse me.
But we're talking. You became a sort of student of the war.
I was enlarging on the idea that one way that my World War II experience affected the rest of my life was making me ask myself, am I really a conscience objector? Am I a pacifist?
Sort of like questioning your own faith.
And my own behavior. My wife or any of my friends can tell you I'm not a nonviolent person. really. I think I know that, and I think that this reflection and reading has led me to a much more firm conviction that I am a pacifist, but I have to say it's partly on religious grounds, and it's partly on the grounds that human life is sacred, but it's also on the grounds that war is self-defeating, and violence is always self-defeating because of the way histories are written, and because of Hollywood. Most people don't think of violent war as being self-defeating. But it is.
Now, you must have run up against the argument that in the case of World War II, the U.S. was defending itself and its allies against aggressors. And so even against violent aggressors,
yes,
you would say that a violent defense is not the way to go.
This is a tough case. The only thing I can say is that it was clear to a lot of people in the 1938 and 39 that Hitler should be stopped. But a lot of national leaders refused to place limits on him. And he saw the opportunity and he left the reservation. He got out of control.
Now, wouldn't those limits themselves have been violent? I mean, that would have required some sort of...
At an early stage, not necessarily. There's simple international approval. There's also economic constraints. And there were a lot of the rest of the world, including Switzerland, my wife's country, which has tried to come to terms with that lately, and the United States, some of our businesses, which have never been willing to come to terms or admit, a lot of them continued to do business with Germany mm-hmm. into the war. And there is some thinking, I don't know how sound it is, that our strategic bombing was selective in avoiding certain properties in which there was an American interest. My point is that this has never come out. Mm-hmm. and my point is that it's the same as the Civil War. It looks to us now in hindsight, well, we had to fight because of the South. But recent histories of John Brown, a biography I wrote of John Brown.
You read or you wrote?
Hmm?
You said you wrote or did
you? I wrote. Excuse me. I think I'll have to. We'll have to wind up this interview, and I'm beginning to. Maybe I'm beginning to. Anyway.
Well, the John Brown biography, what did it tell you?
John Brown was a terrorist, that's what I'm saying. And I think some recent biographies have portrayed this clearly. And before John Brown, abolitionism was not respectable among intelligent, well, people like Mark Twain, intelligent liberal leaders in this country and politicians. He, through his violence, he provoked fear and violence in the South, and he particularly exacerbated the idea that he was, because he said, I'm going to go down and raise a slave army. They would love to rise up and fight against the Southerners, and I'm going to make this happen. Well, you know, this kind of talk is inflammatory. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm not saying that nobody can revisit history and say what could have happened. But at the time, and even now, some historians think that there could have been, there was a political solution, and it could have led to abandonment of slavery in the South.
If conditions had not been inflamed by actions such as abolitionists,
well,
like John Brown.
Well, he certainly helped create a situation where that political accommodation was impossible.
Mm-hmm. So these are some of the thoughts that, this is how your thought has developed,
which is,
since the war.
I think this is an unusual preoccupation for an old guy like me and for middle-class people in general. But yes, it's been a lifetime preoccupation because of my World War II experience. Even though I was a farm boy, what I did was not significant one way or another. I came in late in the war. If I had joined the army, let's face it, that wouldn't have made any difference either. I would have been, as a friend of mine, a classmate of mine, was cannon fodder for Eisenhower's march across France. And he enlisted at about that time, and so he only lasted a week and a half after landing in France before being killed as an infantryman. And my story would have been the same, probably, without making much difference one way or the other. By that time, the war was determined. But in my mind, this is an important distinction, and it's something that's preoccupied me ever since.
I want to go back to your CPS duties and the work at the mental hospital. Was that your final assignment?
Yes, it was.
So what happened then?
I went back to school and finished my bachelor degree.
Now, what do you get from CPS? I mean, if you serve in the military, you get a discharge, hopefully an honorable discharge.
Oh, we had a discharge, I guess, but
a little certificate somewhere saying that.
I suppose I got one. I don't know, or maybe it was a letter saying you can go now. Incidentally, I was the one who. I'm sure I didn't do a good job, but they told me to organize the office and organize the paperwork and send it in and close the unit at Byberry. I was the one who was there at the end and closed it.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what I did at the end of CPS, and then I went back to school. 2 years later, I got a
back to William Penn?
Instead of majoring in physics, I majored in sociology, which led no place. So,
but that was your career, wasn't it?
It became my career. After I got my bachelor's, I had taken some teaching courses, but I didn't really want to teach. So I took a teaching job in northern Iowa, then told him I wasn't coming because I just couldn't face it. I didn't enjoy teaching. And I worked in a factory and as a carpenter, and then went back to school got a master's degree in social work. But then I got the University of Iowa hired me for a project, so I took the opportunity to go back to school again and get a doctorate in sociology, which legitimized me to spend a career in research and so forth, which I have done. Mm-hmm.
You could have stayed with physics. Well, how do you think your life would have been if you had done that?
I think I would have been working for the Defense Department one way or another, because let's face it, everybody in the sciences mostly, nobody looks too closely, but mostly they work for some aspect of the defense industry or the defense budget. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want to do that.
Did you stay in touch over the years with people you knew in CPS? I mean, I don't know if there's any, are there any organizations for that group like there are veterans organizations?
Well, some people have, and some churches have tried to stay in touch. I'm not a reunion person, and I think the people that I knew in CPS I've stayed in touch with are people that probably I knew aside from CPS, that is, from my school before or after. As far as Sydney that I traveled with and other people I did things, I can't. Actually, I thought about that in trying to remember what's happened. I don't believe there were any lifetime connections that grew out of CPS. Mm-hmm. For some of my friends, I know there have been. For me, not. Mm-hmm. It may have been because I moved so much. I don't know.
Okay, so that because you kept on having to break off. And
the people I worked with were I was sort of a transient, and so were they, and they went on to other places. Mm-hmm. And some of them were very congenial people that I liked a lot, but I didn't stay in touch long. Okay.
Over the years, were you ever called upon, asked to talk about those days, or was that something that people just weren't interested
in? No, I haven't. I haven't been called upon. I've been a peace activist. I decided through simple survival, that is, there are so few people left who grew up or were adults during World War II. My experience has become more interesting to others, perhaps because I'm unusual. There aren't very many of us left who served in CPS, same as military service.
So, for instance. And I don't know if you were active in opposition to the Vietnam War.
Yes. Excuse me, but in fact, an aftermath of CPS was that they cranked up the draft again for the Korean War in 1950. And I had traveled to Washington a couple times with others to lobby our congressman against the draft, but of course it went into effect. I wrote a letter to the Des Moines Register. I was working or teaching in Iowa at that time. I wrote a letter to the Des Moines Register and explained, it was a long a long-winded letter to explain why I was refusing to register because I objected to the war. And a couple of men in black suits showed up around my home village of Whittier, Iowa, and interviewed people about who I was and what kind of a person I was. So I suppose the FBI looked into my case and decided I wasn't a good test case because I was never arrested, although I could have been. In the Vietnam, again, I did everything I could to oppose it. I stood up with others to hold up signs. I wrote, I telephoned, I gave money. Mm-hmm.
Were people in the peace movement at all curious about the fact that you had resisted the war in World War II?
Not particularly. No. Perhaps, as I say, recently, because I remember World War II, that's a little bit interesting. I was asked to give a talk. It was at the Champaign Public Library. I was asked to be on a panel with two or three other speakers because of my World War II CO experience.
This is recently?
Oh, it was three or four years ago.
Okay. And did people seem curious then?
Well, they listened. I think I said this to you, Jim Meadows, before the interview, that I'm sure I'm like the veterans you interview. I don't know why anybody would be interested in this experience, I suppose. Mm-hmm. That's always been my opinion, and I haven't expected that people would find it instructive. I think among anti-war people, you have a group of individualists. Everybody has their own angle on why they're against war and their own experience. And it's highly variable. Everything from seasoned Vietnam veterans to everything.
Mm-hmm. Looking back about, all the experiences you've had in the CPS and all the things you told me, what was the hardest thing you did? What was the most difficult or harrowing experience?
Going through that?
Yeah. Oh.
I suppose the most harrowing was my experience in the mental hospital to see people who are, well, for example, I had to change the bed for a man who had syphilis for many years. When I picked him up, I realized he was hollow, literally hollow. Mm-hmm. He weighed about 50 or 60 pounds. And to pick up somebody like that and realize this is a human being who's literally a hollow shell, and he's still living, barely, and to see things like that, to see the, well, and I mentioned being in the violent building. There was a ward in the violent building, B-26, and all of us had to help over there once in a while. These were the most violent of the violent men, and a number of them were beautiful, there's no other word for it, heroic and beautiful physical specimens, because they were black men who were in the boxing game in Philadelphia, and they had become hooked on drugs, undoubtedly from painkillers, morphine, and so forth. They'd become addicts and had needed more and more drugs and had gotten in trouble because of that. But they still, several of them still had their strength and their physique from boxing days. And these men, this was another horrifying, I think he'd use the term horrifying, this is another very difficult experience to see these men chained to their beds.
They were literally chained.
They were literally, they had manacles around their wrists and some of them around their feet as well. Big John, who never gave us any trouble, if he had, it would have taken four or five of us to handle him. He was a large-sized heavyweight boxer, but his hands were chained to his bed. He, from years of taking drugs, his mind was really in bad shape, but he was very friendly. And he had learned that he could since his feet were not manacled, he could put his feet over the edge. He picked up his bed and put it over his head and went around and greeted people and the attendants. "Hello," he said. "How are you today? Hello." It was like an old lady making the rounds of her friends at tea time. He wanted to nod and say hello to everybody. And that was Big John, but then there were others. That was another horrifying, that ward in general. And when once one of the men had to be taken to the hospital, he was a boxer who was still in excellent condition, and a serious drug addict. He had to be taken to the hospital for something he needed very badly. The nurse wanted to give him a sedative. He knew that this sedative, she was trying to give him the sedative in one arm. He was trying to get the needle as a weapon, and it wouldn't make much of a weapon, but he wanted it. So he was flexing his muscle and taking the other hand, and there were four of us CO guys trying to hold his arms and legs, and we couldn't do it. Mm-hmm. We had to, as I recall, they finally gave up on the whole project.
What sort of drugs had these people been addicted to?
I couldn't say. I say morphine because I've only become acquainted at all with drug problems the last 20, 30 years. At the time, I was totally uninformed. I didn't know, I didn't understand anything. Mm-hmm. But I assume that all of them had, well, they all had injuries from boxing. And I suppose that morphine and others were used to kill the pain and possibly to, and permit them to keep boxing. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But I'm just guessing.
Now, I hadn't asked, were you an only child? Did you have any siblings?
I had a brother and a sister.
And did your brother go into the service?
My brother came along later. He was a CO in the Vietnam.
So the younger brother.
My younger brother.
Okay.
He did alternative service, and he ran into unfriendliness, then also acceptance. But
Did he come to you with questions about dealing with that sort of
no.
stuff?
Uh-huh. No. Incidentally, my grandfather was, my great-grandfather was a CO in the Civil War. My father was a CO in World War I, but being a farm boy, he was never called up. Mm-hmm. His family needed him.
So this is really a family tradition of taking this road.
On my father's side, there's a long history of being Quakers, and this is part of it.
Now, have you had any kids yourself?
My son, David, I believe he got CO classification, but wasn't, his number didn't come up in.
And that would have been during when?
Yeah, when was that?
Was that in Vietnam? Or
must have been.
In the 1960s?
Maybe my brother didn't come along. He must, maybe that must have been in the Korean War when he was called. I don't know.
Okay. So both your brother, your brother was a CO who did service.
Anyway, he was a CO.
Your son was would have been the Vietnam War era?
Yeah.
Okay. So no dissenters, it sounds, at least on your father's side. Or else you could say that you were all dissenters.
Well, no, there's, you're right. Mm-hmm. On my father's side, and on my mother's side, among my cousins and so forth, there's no COs, mm-hmm. no trace of that kind of thinking.
So the split in the family then that way was.
I have many very good friends among those cousins on the mother's side, but they're not pacifists. Mm-hmm.
But it was something that was just really very strong, it sounds like, with everybody on on your dad's side, well, with you?
Remember that I went to boarding school. Mm-hmm. I was raised, I went to Quaker meeting when I was small. I heard the talk, but I went to boarding school for 4 years and then to a Quaker college. And I, so, yes, I heard a lot about it.
And it's something that's, and it's something that, that really seems to really stick with people. I'm thinking, wasn't, because I'm wondering that maybe the popular example, I think there was even an old Gary Cooper movie where he played a Quaker who...
he decided he had to take up the gun, I believe, yeah.
And that might seem to be the popular picture for people who are not from the Peace Churches, well, that this doesn't really have any staying power.
I never really thought about it, but I don't really know of any cases. Maybe there are, of people who were serious COs and then decided, this is all a mistake. I should be carrying a gun and enlisted. I suppose there must be, but I think I would have, should have heard of them, but I've never heard of any.
So even though it sounds a little bit like, you know, swimming upstream in terms of popular opinion in this society, there's enough to sustain people to keep on doing it.
I think, well, I think everyone, I'm sure you know, and everyone knows that once you take a position, to some extent, you may become stronger because you have to you have to justify having taken that position. And maybe there's a maybe there's an element of that in my own story. There probably is. Mm-hmm. But aside from that, I don't know of people. I'm sure there are people who have deserted the CO position. I don't know of any myself. Mm-hmm.
For people today, what do you think people should know about your experience? What's the important thing that they need to know?
What I think is important is something that has burdened my mind. I know there's nothing whatsoever I can do about it, but it increasingly has bothered me because there's so much evidence that these young men who are volunteering for military service or the National Guard, they are disproportionately low income and perhaps disproportionately small town young men. And they're certainly disproportionately low income. They have a mixture, I believe, of hopefulness that they're going to find a career, they're going to be useful. They're going to serve their country, quote unquote, and at the same time, my neighbor, who's a dear friend, is proud of his military service, and he's pushed his son into it with this kind of thinking. And in my own family, I have people like that. I think that these. I think these young men don't have the faintest idea what they're getting into. And we in the peace movement side, we do hear from hundreds, if not thousands, of men who have simply walked away, who have tried to get CO status, or who are very unhappy, I think in some cases probably are become mentally disturbed because when they find out what they've gotten into, they realize this is not for me. How do I relate this to my experience is that when I went into to CPS, I was not at all sure of that's what I should do. But because, brought out, because of my family and family-friendly connections and a history, that's what I did. And so my life has been very different, for better or worse, in this direction. And these young men, I feel, they're getting into something way over their head. For some of them, completely intolerable and unacceptable. They don't know that they're going to be trained to become cold-blooded killers.
And do you think maybe today in this war, that because there is no draft, that these questions are being raised even less because it's so easy to avoid military service?
I have to say that everything about this war is political, and there's no draft for political reasons, because if we had a draft, there would be no war. That's very clear. I think everybody sees that. Mm-hmm. The war wouldn't last a week.
Today, when you talk about these issues with people who... Can you talk about these issues with people who don't agree with you?
Increasingly, the man in the street, if there is such a creature, the average guy has more and more questions. That's very clear. We see that in public opinion polls, newspapers, mm-hmm. and even, I shouldn't say this, but even journalists are catching on. I shouldn't say this to a man who's a journalist.
But your own experience in talking to people, can you talk about these issues?
It's changed. Yes, I can. And much more easily than 2 years ago, if that's what you're wondering.
So like when the war in Iraq first began, was it hard to bring up, you know, your own ideas?
There was a knee-jerk reaction, which historians and militarists, too, understand very well. Oh, you have to support the president. You have to support the war. You can't be against it. And we have to support our troops as if we're doing them a favor to send them over there to get killed for nothing.
Mm-hmm. But now, at least today,
other people are seeing this the way that I have just described. They're being killed for nothing. Mm-hmm. I think an increasing number of military, of the parents of young men, are being sent back because the politicians are not willing to institute a draft because they know that will be the end of the war. Mm-hmm. The people in the White House need this war, and they're not going to give it up.
Mm-hmm. In the long haul, I mean, looking back on the on your own experience and the conflicts that the U.S. has been in since then, do you foresee any basic change in what countries do as far as conflict is concerned?
This is a beautiful question.
Do you think anything's going to change, or is human nature?
It's a very, very large question. People better qualified than I to address it, I think, are saying that in spite of the violence that we see, that there's a change in the nature of violence. That's clear. And perhaps there's, contrary to general impressions, perhaps there's a reduction in the number of people suffering or killed from violence. I think what this, to me, one of the bottom lines clearly is that when people have something to live for, that is a job, a decent income, they're not interested in war anymore. That's why if you look at the members of Congress and their families in the Korean War when we had a draft, I think there was one or none member of any congressman's family, maybe I have this wrong, who actually served in the military in the Korean War. I'm not sure that that's true, but that, I think that's not far off. In other words, in the Vietnam War again, people who had money to go to school or do something, they didn't have to go. I think people see this, and in other words, when you have life chances, and you have the self-respect that money helps bring, a job, your own home, and so forth, then people who have that don't want war. The people who, the people that were yapping about all the time, the terrorists on our side and the other side, are people who are, who don't have life chances, basically. They have nothing to live for, so they're willing to go out and die for something, to a large extent, not exclusively.
I wanted, I guess this is more of like chronological housekeeping. I know that you grew up in Iowa and you went to school in Iowa. When did you come to Illinois?
I came to Illinois because I had a good offer from this top university.
This one here?
Illinois in 1963 and 4.
Okay.
And by that time, I had worked my way up to being an assistant professor in the University of Iowa. And I was beginning to publish. And so at that time, it was difficult to find teachers, even more difficult than it is now.
So that's when you came to the University of Illinois.
Correct.
And you began teaching, even though you weren't crazy about teaching earlier.
When I retired, I said, well, finally, 3 years before I retired, I learned how to be a good teacher. I was half serious when I said that. I think that I've always had trouble of being too intellectual and expecting my students to catch on too fast. They've told me that over and over. Not paying enough attention to the necessity of being entertaining as a teacher. Mm-hmm. I finally learned that late in my career, and certainly they don't teach you that in education colleges. And when, yes, pardon me.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, when I did high school practice teaching in a high school as an undergraduate student, I just couldn't connect to the students.
When did you retire?
When did I retire? 1990.
Okay. So you've been, it's over 40 years that you've been here in Champaign-Urbana.
That's correct.
Okay. And your time opposing the Vietnam War was also here.
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah, I stood up down by the statues. The alumni statues.
Okay.
That's where we used to stand up to.
The alma mater.
Yeah, alma mater.
Okay.
That's where we used to stand up with the "Get Out of Vietnam" signs.
Mm. Well, I think that wraps up the questions I had. I want to know if there are any particular areas that you wanted to talk about.
Heavens! I've said too much about too many things, and I appreciate your help in arranging and preparing me for this interview and doing the interview. Thank you very much.
Well, Mr. Tabor, thank you. That was about an hour and three quarters.
Oof.
Maybe an hour and 40.
I wouldn't have believed it was possible.
No.
But it's your interviewing, I have to say.
Well,
if I were left to tell a story,